You are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. I am delighted that you are here, and I think you're going to be delighted as well. Some of you are joining us for the very first time. Welcome. We're glad you're here. Now, got an email today from one of our listeners who said, you know, I was watching NASA TV, and it was live, and it was showing, you know, the space shuttle. The space shuttle is up there right now on the Hubble repair mission, as you know. They've just finished, just wrapped up the Hubble repair mission and have redeployed the satellite, Hubble, back out into space. And anyway, the email said there was this big UFO hovering above the shuttle. And so then they cut away to something else, and then in a little bit they went back to the shuttle, and the UFO was still there, so they cut away to the mission control room, and all the guys in the mission control room were kind of excitedly pointing up at the screen and talking about something, and you couldn't hear them. And the email said, it's not hard to guess what it is they were talking about. I hope you were listening last night when I read an email that I received. One of our listeners had written to NASA and said, well, look, if the atmosphere on Mars is really as thin as you guys say it is, virtually non-existent, how do you use parachutes when you land things there? How does that work? And I read their response, and their response was so totally, completely non-responsive. They didn't even acknowledge his question. They talked about everything, including how they're helping with the economic recovery of America. Oh, well, unintended guests, I guess. So a UFO made an appearance on NASA TV today. Two appearances. Okay, well, that's cool. K-Files E-Zine is our weekly newsletter, and it's absolutely free. So there's really no reason for you not to be getting it, especially if you have any questions along the way about anything. It probably has been in the K-Files E-Zine. And what's the genius in not getting it? It's free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. It's you're not locked in for life. It's not a life sentence. Although we have a very large number of our subscribers who have been with us since the very beginning, way back in 2000. So it's a good publication, and it's free. So go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and subscribe. You'll see it says K-Files E-Zine in red letters. Just click that and subscribe. We had an electric blitz here last night. Right after the show, the electricity went off and then back on, and you could hear that strange electric groaning sound out there on the lines. Don't know what happened, but it killed the cable. And so everything we do is on the Internet, right? I mean, I live on the Internet. The telephone systems are on the Internet. The TV feed is on the Internet, radio feed on the Internet, emails on the Internet. I couldn't do anything because the cable was dead. And it remained dead till this afternoon, so I've been busily trying to catch up and reply to some of your emails. If I'm a little late replying today, that's the reason I'm trying to catch up. My guest is Frances Emma Barwood, and she will join us on the other side of this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Frances Emma Barwood. I think probably that's a name that most of you are already familiar with, and she's been with us before. She was on the Phoenix City Council back in 1997 when the Phoenix Lights incident took place. And she did something virtually unheard of in politics. She listened to her constituents, and she responded to their wishes. And she represented them. She stood up for them. Others have fallen. Frances Emma Barwood is still standing, and welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Are you with us, Frances?
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Frances, I don't want us to just rehash everything that we talked about before. However, I do want us to talk a little bit about the Phoenix Lights incident, because some people probably haven't heard your story. But basically, the Phoenix Lights incident took place, and you got flooded with calls from and letters from people that you represent wanting to know who's investigating this, what's going on, and you simply asked that question in a city council meeting, right?
That's true. Do you want me to start from the beginning?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. I was on my way to the Tuesday City Council meeting, which is the only live televised meeting, and I was stopped by a woman, a reporter named Cindy from Extra TV, and she asked me if I would find out what it was that went over Arizona. And this was on May 6th, and I thought something just happened. So I said, well, when did this happen? She goes, oh, back in March. And I'm thinking, March? You know, I don't even remember anything that happened in March. And she told me, and I said, well, didn't you ask the mayor's office? And she said, well, the mayor's office, the mayor wouldn't talk to her and just issued a statement saying there are no UFOs over Arizona. And I thought, well, that was kind of strange. If a vehicle flew over Arizona and our city, wouldn't they be concerned as a public safety issue? So she asked me if I would ask for an investigation. I told her I would, and I went in. At one part of the meeting, it's called Council Request, and you can ask any question of any level of government or anything to do with the city or anything that you think is pertinent that needs to be answered. So came my turn, and I asked, could we find out what it was that flew over Arizona on March 13th? And normally what happens is they give you two staff members, they assign it to two staff members, and then they get back to you within a week and, you know, let you know what they're finding out and how much longer it will take to get an answer.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was everybody turned around and looked at me, including the staff members, and it was like kind of awkward, and then somebody made some joke, I don't remember what it was, and it went on to the next council member. And I thought, well, that was really strange. So after the meeting, I asked probably one of the few staff members that I trusted, who always was honest and forthright, and I asked him if he could find out what, you know, why did everybody react like that? And he said, well, you really shouldn't ask, you shouldn't have asked that question. And I said, why? And he said, well, because the mayor told everybody not to talk about this. And I said, well, he didn't tell me. And he looked at me, and I figured, oh, he's right. If he would have told me not to talk about it, I would have intentionally found out what was going on before then. And so they didn't assign it to anybody. And after that was kind of interesting, because the next thing I knew was in the hall. Well, first of all, they were the cartoons in the Arizona Republic. And
the what?
Friday, a reporter, Chris Fiscus, came in and asked if he could...
Wait a minute. Now, you said these were in the Arizona Republic? Is that the same newspaper that I always hear referred to as the Arizona Repulsive?
Yeah. He interviewed me on a Friday so that it would go into the weekend staff editorial to be allowed to go into the paper. And he knew that if he did it during the week, they wouldn't have allowed it at all, and or they would have edited it so badly. So he put it intentionally in for the weekend staff, and they put his whole article in there on the front page. Well, it came out Saturday, May 10th, and starting at 7 o'clock in the morning, we started getting phone calls. And the first phone call I got was from a man in Prescott Valley, which is where I live now. And I have never met the man, and I haven't found him since then. But he was having, that night, he was having a hellbop party and had a whole bunch of people over, about 20-something. And they were having a good time and watching hellbop. He said all of a sudden, they all sensed something above them. And they looked up, and he said there was this object that was so huge, but they could kind of see through it, kind of murky, seeing through it, the sky and the stars and everything. And he said they all stood there and watched it, and it took a long time for it to pass. And after it was gone, they went back to their hellbop party. And he hadn't thought about it anymore until the article appeared in the paper. And I thought, you know, that was really unusual that somebody would forget something that, you know, was that phenomenal. But then I got another call and another call and another call, and that day, I don't even know how many calls, but it lasted till almost 11 o'clock that night, and I was exhausted writing down people's names and numbers, by which point I realized something really astounding happened. And you know, that many people can't tell you the same story, and they all describe the same thing, something so huge, bigger than a football field or a mile wide, you know, it was huge, and completely silent, very obvious, very slow, very low. Not one of them told me they were afraid. They said they were astounded, amazed, excited, but not one of them was afraid.
You did not see this Phoenix Lights object, right?
I hadn't seen, and I didn't even have any info about any UFO things or anything. I mean, this was my first rude awakening. But it was interesting because Sunday, which was Mother's Day, May 10th, I got so many more phone calls. And then when I got into the office on Monday, my whole voicemail was completely full, and they had left messages in all the other council members and the mayor's office for me. So they try to get me a message in any which way they can. So my assistant went and got all the names and numbers, and that was kind of the beginning of, like, what is going on here? Because over the summer, I called every single one of them back, and over 700 people. And of those 700 people, there was only, maybe three or four that were either alone or only with one other person. There were people that were at Little League games. There were people that were out shopping, jogging. It was a wonderful night that night. It was, you know, everybody was out looking at the hellbop. It was a fascinating thing to see in the sky for so long. And it was amazing to me. And they all described the same thing. The only thing I couldn't understand, and I'll explain that to you until a year later, I couldn't understand how they could forget something like that. Not all of them, but a big portion of them, I would say 90%, could forget something completely until they read the article. And then it jogged their memory. And I'll tell you what happened to me a year later.
All right.
Or a year, almost a year and a half later, that kind of made me understand what happened.
Okay.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. On November 14th of 1998, we were listening to the local radio show. Do you remember the late Frank Baranowski?
Mm-hmm.
And he had said, he got a phone call, and we were actually in bed, and it was kind of chilly that night, so we were just laying there listening to him. And a woman called in, and she said, "Did you see what's in the eastern sky?" And he said, "No, but two of his security people at the station had come in and said, you got to go out and see this thing." So he said, "I will during the break." Well, then I said, "Oh, I got to go out and see what this is." So my husband and I went out, and we looked in the eastern sky, and there was this huge, very, very bright cylinder at a slight tilt, like straight up but slightly tilted to the left. And I said, "My goodness, what is it?" And at first I thought it was the space station. And then I went between a tree twig in our front yard, and I stood there, and that thing did not move, not at all. So I went and called my friend who lived in right by Scottsdale Air Park at the time, Patty Seekman, and I said, "Patty, can you go out on your balcony, look to the east, and tell me what you see?" Well, it was 11:30 at night, and I woke her up. And so she did go out there, and she looked, she came back, she goes, "Oh, my God, I don't know what that is." And she said, "You know what's funny is last night at Scottsdale Air Park, there was a whole bunch of military people, vehicles and helicopters and everything." And she said, that was on Friday the 13th, and she said, I don't know what they were doing there. And she said, "And then tonight it's this." So I said, "Well, I'm going back outside to look at it some more." So, and she did too. So I hung up. And we're outside and we're looking at it, and all of a sudden we felt so extremely tired. It was almost like we were drugged. And I said, "I've got to go. I am so tired, I got to go lay down." So we went to bed. Next Thursday, we're driving down the road, and there's the advertisement on the radio for Frank Baranowski's show. And all of a sudden I remembered, and I thought, "Oh my goodness, why didn't I think of this until now?" And so I didn't remember it at all. And then I thought, well, you know, so I said to my husband, "Do you remember that thing we saw last Saturday night up in the sky?" And he looked at me and he goes, "No." And then I thought, oh, maybe I dreamt it. So I called Patty. And I said, "Patty, do you remember that thing that was in the eastern sky last Saturday night?" And she goes, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "I forgot all about it until just now." She goes, "So did I." And then my husband remembered it. And it was like, why did we totally forget that? And the only thing I can think of is when it's either outside the parameters of your thinking, you just erase it. Or it's like when you have, like someone has a traumatic accident, and then, you know, they say, "I don't remember anything that happened."
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. But it explained it to me, because that was the one thing I couldn't understand is, and then especially me, why didn't I call the police? Why didn't I call the newspapers? Why didn't I call the TV stations? I did nothing.
Well, I haven't had that happen with reference to a UFO, but a couple of years back I had a stroke. And I called my sister from the hospital, so she says. Now, I don't recall that telephone call. And I don't know whose telephone I would have used, because I don't carry a cell phone.
Whoa.
So I don't know. I to this day do not remember calling her. She swears that I called her and told her I was in the hospital.
Wow.
So, I can identify with what you're saying, because I've had a similar thing based on a different traumatic kind of experience. Now, for our listeners who don't know the name Frank Baranowski, he was a radio talk show host here in the Phoenix area. And his show was somewhat like this one. He dealt with some of the weird topics we deal with and was very, very popular. And is no longer with us. Now, you people who tried to bring you videotape, at least one person who tried to bring you video of this Phoenix Lights incident, had in fact a little bit of an incident with Men in Black, didn't he?
And this was, you know, as it turned out, I truly believe everything. But in the beginning, I didn't. And what happened was one day, my phone, I was the only one on the council that had my phone number in the phone book. So when people need, and nobody abused it, you know, it was like, if you need something, call me because I'm there. That's what my job is. And so this man calls me, his name was Richard Curtis, and he said that, you know, he had read the article in the paper, and he said, I took video that night. He goes, I have professional video equipment, and I have a big professional CB base. And he says, I'm always listening to the truckers, and he said, I'm a disabled veteran, and he said, this is my hobby. And so he said, I was listening to the truckers coming down I-17, and they were talking about, back and forth between the truckers, about this humongous object that was headed very slowly going south. And so he thought, well, I'll go up on the roof, and I'll videotape it because it's got to be coming my way. And so he did. He went up on the roof, and he videotaped one tape, and then he ran out of the tape. He put in another tape, so he had two tapes. And he said, you wouldn't believe how big this thing was. He says, it was huge, and he got, you know, he said he could see the entire structure. So I said to him, well, could you make a copy and get it to my office? So he said he would. He would send it. I gave him the address of City Hall. He said he would get it over to my office. Well, 2 weeks later, he calls me up, and he said, well, what did you think of the tapes? And I said, I never got them. And he said, well, they came from your office to get them. And I said, who came from my office? He said, two men. I said, well, I don't have any men in my office. I've got my assistant is a female, my intern is a female, and my secretary is a female.
Francis, we have to take a break. I want to pick up right there. We want to hear all of this story. We'll be back with more of this fascinating story from Francis Emma Barwood right after this break. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Francis Emma Barwood. And when the break interrupted us, Francis, you were telling us about the guy, Richard Curtis, who had two videotapes, and he thought someone from your office came to pick them up.
Right. And what happened was, I kind of wouldn't have believed all this except that there were two witnesses, and they were seen. I found out after, because I didn't know where he lived. I hadn't asked him where he lived, but he lived in the Westwood Hotel, which was converted to a housing for disabled people and disabled veterans. And the roof he was talking about was downtown, and he also said that the lights from downtown had reflected on this object, and it was a very dull, almost the same color as the sky, except that he said he could see through it, like murky, just like everyone else said. And the manager of the hotel and a minister who counseled with all the people in the hotel both saw this vehicle pull up. It was black with black windows, two men got out. They were both dressed the same in July, 110 degrees, with three-piece suits and hats and sunglasses. And, you know, at this point I'm thinking, oh, really, you know, that if it wasn't for those witnesses, I had discarded this as this guy made this all up. But then after, you know, with these witnesses, it was like, well, he couldn't have made it up. I mean, it happened.
Well, and let's say for the audience who, you know, unless you've lived here in the summer, you really don't have a feel for this. We are in May right now, already hotter. Our weather's already hotter than most people will see all year. We're above 100 each day. And in 1997, if I'm not mistaken, I looked this up one time, but I think it got to 119 degrees that summer.
Yeah, it was pretty warm.
Mm-hmm. And so the point is, folks, nobody here wears suits in the summer. Nobody. So I'm sorry, Francis. Go ahead.
Well, they asked where his room was, and they told him. And they went up. Now, on Richard's side of what happened, they knocked on his door. He opened the door. They asked him if he had the tapes from March 13th. And he said, are you from Francis Barwood's office? And they said yes. So they didn't volunteer that. He gave it to them. And anyway, they asked him if he had copies. He said he hadn't made the copies yet, but that they would make copies and bring it back to him, bring his originals back. Of course, that was the end of that. And at first I thought he made this all up, but after finding out, you know, the witnesses, and then after all this, he was on television. He did tell his story on television.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, something happened with the medication that he was taking for his injuries. And that was the end of Richard Curtis. Nobody knows what happened or where he is or anything. And so it was a very strange thing. It, you know, I mean, you hear jokes about Men in Black and all of that, and it's like, goodness, you know, who were these men? Where did they come from? You know, what were they doing in three-piece suits and, you know, 110 degrees? And what is going on here? About that same time, all the cartoons and all everything that was locally in our local paper it was being bombarded. And what was interesting is newspapers from other states and from around the world and radio shows from, you know, England and Africa and every place else that called me and interviewed me, they were all really pleasant. It was just the local news media and the mayor of Phoenix at the time.
Okay, now
passing out cards to people when he went to meetings, and they said, Frances Emmer Barwood from the planet Xenon, speak into the tinfoil and she will hear you. And then they put a sign on my picture in the lobby saying the same thing. And my thought was, what are they afraid of? You know, why don't they want to know what this is?
Francis, the mayor at that time, wasn't that Skip Remsa?
It was.
Where is he today?
Nobody seems to know. He did try to run for Secretary of State the last time, and I guess there was some discrepancies in his petitions, and he dropped out.
Okay. Now, I have to tell you how I became aware of you. I didn't tell you this last time. At the time when all this was happening, I was international police, and I had just been deployed to Bosnia. And at that time, I had never lived in Arizona before. So I came to Arizona when I finished being international police.
Well.
Okay. But I went on the internet one day. I was over at headquarters, and I went on the internet to see if I had any email, and then I just looked around in the current news, you know, what's going on, and I saw a cartoon. And my mind said, what's this all about? And so I started checking into it and trying to find out what it was all about, and discovered the story then about you standing up for your constituents, and I assumed the cartoon then was the standard mud-sucking media ridicule of anything having to do with UFOs. But that's where I became aware of you, was through one of those cartoons on the internet. It was on the internet, and I read it in Bosnia.
That's funny.
Now, one other thing that I think people need to know about this whole affair, there's really, your story is huge, but there is one more really pivotal point in the story that I want us to talk about, and then I'd like for us to kind of move into this something else, your brush with death recently, and what that was all about and what happened with that, because that too is an amazing story. You got shot at during this period of time.
I did. Let me put it this way. My dad was chief investigator for the city of New York back under Mayor Wagner. And he always said, you know, if a job becomes more important than doing what's right, you've sold your soul. He also said, if you want to find out something, don't let it go until you find the answer. So there were a lot of things that went before the city council that were kind of controversial. And I just felt, say what it is and say, you know, how your constituents feel about it and vote that way. So there were other things that were controversial at the time. And one day I was driving home, and I had 11 death threats. So, you know, I was a little cautious. And one of the death threats was in letter form. Some of them were actually faxed to my office. But this one particular was sent to my house, and they said they knew where my daughter lived in Tempe, and that I had better watch myself. And so I called her and made her move. And she did. You know, I just said, this is not a joke. You got to move. So she did. She was renting a place, so that wasn't a problem. And so I always watched when I got into my car if anybody was following me or around me. And you know, so nobody was. And I came home, you know, the regular way. I always came home on the 51, and, you know, everything was fine. And I got to my house and parked in my front yard, perpendicular to my front picture window. And I had a Jeep Cherokee, white Jeep Cherokee. And it was not the newest, but it wasn't really, really old. But I had all my stuff on the seat next to me and my purse on the console between. And I went to pick up my papers to read over the weekend when my purse... I opened the door, and my purse fell to the back, so my door kind of closed as I went for my purse, and I heard a ka-tunk, and I thought, what the heck was that? At first, I thought the car was falling apart, and so I went into the house, brought my paperwork in, came back out to get the rest of it in my purse, and I noticed on my driver's side door there was a really deep divot. I don't know how else to say it. It was really dented in, and the paint was gone. And I thought, that's really strange. It was right under the handle. And I thought, I didn't notice that when I got in the car. I surely would have noticed it. So I thought, must have happened on the freeway. So I called my son. He came over, and he looked, and he said, Mom, he goes, didn't you notice the picture window? And I said, no. And he goes, you don't have a picture window anymore. So what happened was they shot at me, it ricocheted. If the car door wouldn't have, you know, started to close again as I reached over for the other stuff, it would have, the police officer said, would have gotten me right under my left armpit and probably would have killed me. And it shot out my front window. It was completely gone and on my floor, and I didn't even notice it. And so needless to say, the police were there. They were all over the place, and they figured that the person who did this was behind the bushes diagonally across the street, And, you know, you never look around your house when you come. I didn't anyway. Mm-hmm. And apparently they were waiting for me for a while. And I'll tell you, I was never so, and I'm not easily intimidated. I was never so terrified in my whole life. And I shook from my head to my feet. And they put a 24-hour police guard on me. And then we left and went up to the cabin that we had at the time. And I was like, I was afraid to go to the door. I was afraid of everything. And after about 6 days, I thought, if I don't snap out of this, they win. And all of a sudden I decided, you know what, whatever going to happen is going to happen. And I totally wasn't afraid anymore. But it was quite an experience, and I think, and I've told you this before, everything that's happened, the cartoons, the ridicule, the, you know, all the nonsense stuff, including being shot at, that was the worst that I had. I've already had my tires slashed and everything. But the whole thing is it's not just for me. It's a message to others. It's like, If you don't shut up, this is what we're going to do to you.
Well, these are terrorist tactics. And I don't know who did this, and you don't know. But even if they happen to work for the government, they need to hear and know. And they're listening. One of my largest segments of my audience is U.S. government computers. But they need to hear that the whole world knows you are terrorists. If you do this, even if you do it under orders, you're a terrorist, and you're a criminal, and you're an enemy of freedom. And sooner or later, the American people will have enough of you, and they will have you for dinner. It happens in every country where the government becomes oppressive and terroristic. Sooner or later, they get strung up. And so these guys who do this, if they're doing it on the orders of the government, and I'm not saying they are, I don't know. But the people who do this, no matter, even if you are government and you say, I'm just following orders, we own the government. We're your employer, and we will jerk your chain. We have to take a break. We'll be back. More with Francis Emma Barwood right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking with Francis Emma Barwood. And Francis, I'd like for us to get this information to people about what has recently happened to you. You have recently had a very serious health situation, a brush with death, so to speak. Tell us about it.
Well, back in January, right after I turned 65, and I was feeling really good, I got bit by a tick, and I didn't realize it. I had scratched something off my skin, you know, just like you would do if you had something, and you just kind of scratch it off. It was itchy. And didn't realize it, that something was wrong, and a day or so later, I started out with a really, really bad sore throat. And then it went down into my lungs, and I got a lung infection. And they put me on antibiotics, but it wouldn't clear. So they kept me on antibiotics. They kept changing them. And nothing was helping. And then it started clearing up. And then the next thing that happened was my knees swole up and my elbows swole up. And every time I had another symptom, the bug bite would swell up. And so this was going on from January 28th about until March 4th. And on March 4th, the bug bite again swole up really bad. And this was like my eighth or ninth trip to the ER and to my doctor. I went four times to my doctor by that point. And I kept telling them, I think this bite is related to what's happening to me. And they said, no, that bite's a spider bite. And then I said, well, it just swells up every time, you know, and then I get sick again, or I get sick and I look and it's swollen up. And they said, well, you know, it has nothing to do with it. Well, on March 4th in the morning, the bug bite swelled up so bad, and it was my daughter's birthday, so I remember the date. And my doctor said, well, go into the emergency room. So I did, and the doctor looked at it, and she goes, I don't know what this is, but it's not a spider bite. And so she gave me a prescription for cream, so I went to the pharmacist. And by which point, I was pretty depressed because each time that I would have a symptom, it would be worse, and my good days were disappearing, and it was mostly bad days. And all my joints hurt, and my whole body hurt. And it would subside, but it would never go away. And so I said to the pharmacist, can I run something past you? And I gave him the whole scenario from the beginning. And he looked at it, and he goes, oh, that's a tick bite. And I thought, okay, well, that's a tick bite. And so later that day, my knee had been hurting, and then my left knee, and then my right knee. And then later that day, my knees swole up really bad, and I put ace bandage on the left one, and it didn't help. And I was taking Tylenol, and that didn't help. And then my elbow swole up, and I couldn't walk. And so I went into the emergency room, and I said to the doctor, he goes, did you fall? And I said, no. And he goes, well, your knees are really swollen and your elbows. And he said, are you sure you didn't fall? And I said, yeah, I didn't fall. And I said, this has been going on since January. And I said, the pharmacist said, it's a tick bite. And he said, oh, we don't have Lyme disease in Arizona. And so, but the pharmacist told me that we did. And so he goes out, and about 15 minutes later, he comes back in. And he said, I'm giving you doxycycline. And, you know, so you find out all these things later that doxycycline is the treatment for Lyme disease. And so I was lucky because I had been on an antibiotic almost this whole time because of the lung infection. And so anyway, he said, you need to go to your doctor like tomorrow. So I got in 2 days later. And the doctor looked at it, and he actually apologized. He said, I'm sorry, I did not recognize it. And he said, I just had no idea there was Lyme in Arizona. And so he, you know, kept me on the doxycycline, which wasn't helping much. So then he switched me to erythromycin, and I still wasn't doing good. And then my spine swole up, and if I would try to even turn or bend, I would lose all power from just above my waist down, and I would fall. So I kept falling. So then I went into the emergency room at nighttime. And I told him, I said, you know, I've got this tick bite and apparently Lyme disease. And so they said, and they did a whole bunch of tests, and the first Lyme test came back negative, which it was done too early, they said. And so the nurse, my heart doctor, because I have this little strange little heart thing, my heart doctor had seen me the week before, and he said if he didn't know it was a tick bite, he would have sworn I had lupus. And then that day in the emergency room, the nurse said, if I didn't know that was a tick bite, I would think for sure you had MS. And then my doctor thought it had gone into meningitis because my spine was swollen and I was getting headaches, not bad, but, you know, headaches. And I was running a fever almost all the time. And I was pretty miserable, and they did a blood test that night, and then they put me on a drip of morphine, and I can't take pain meds. It just makes me wacky, and it doesn't kill the pain. And so he came back in. He said, do you still have the pain? I said, yeah. Well, they gave me more morphine, so I was, like, really out of it. And then he came in, and he said, do you have liver disease? And I said, no. And he said, you need to get to your doctor tomorrow. So, again, it was 2 days later. on the way to the doctor, I turn on the radio, and there's a friend of ours who has a radio show up here, has this naturopath. And so I called in, and I asked if she knew anything about Lyme. And she said, as a matter of fact, I cured myself from Lyme, and I'll call you after the show. And so she and so I went to the doctor, and the doctor said that my blood test showed that my liver function, and I don't know what the letters stand for, but the ALT is supposed to be between 30 and 62 or something. It was 571, and the AST, which is supposed to be 30 to 40, was 200 and something. And he said that shows severe liver damage, and he said, or you could have a stone. And I said, well, I don't have a gallbladder anymore. So he said, I'm sending you in for an emergency ultrasound, which he did, and no stone. But my liver was greatly enlarged and obviously not functioning well. And it was painful. And so I was pretty depressed. And that was a Friday. And so Friday afternoon, this Donna called me. And she said for me to get this stuff called Ledum, L-E-D-U-M, Polestri. Well, I had no idea what this is. And she says it's a homeopathic remedy. And, you know, you kind of taught like, oh, yeah, right, homeopathic stuff, uh-huh, doesn't work. And so I just kind of brushed it off. And I was in, I just wanted to go to bed, so I went to bed. And the next day, my husband went to a meeting on Saturday, and after that went over and picked up this stuff at New Frontiers up in Prescott. And, you know, it was a little vial of 80 pellets, and I'm thinking to myself, this looks like candy, and this is never going to work. But I promised her I would take it, and so I took the doses, 5 pellets, 3 times a day, but it was already late Saturday, so I took it that day, and then I took again in the morning. And about 9 o'clock on Sunday, it was like, I can't explain it, it was like a veil was lifted off, all my pain went away, everything. And it was like, oh my goodness. So then I'm thinking, this is a fluke, this is not going to last, and I shouldn't get my hopes up. But I kept taking it. And so on Monday, she told me to cut back to 1 dose a day, which would be just 5 pellets in the morning. By Monday afternoon, late afternoon, I was starting to get pain again, so I took another dose, and I ended up going back to 3 times a day. And she said, you know, I had just a very virulent reaction to the Lyme. And I've been on it ever since, and it is now, it was 3 weeks last Sunday that I've been totally out of pain and absolutely no symptoms. And then I decided about a week and a half ago to find out what this stuff is. So I went online and I put in, what is Ledum Polystri, and a question mark. And the first thing that came up was from Wikipedia. And so I printed it out, and on the second page it says, in 1991, the Russians did a study of this Ledum Polystri, and they deactivated the bacteria that causes encephalitis and Lyme. And it was like, holy cow, you know, why didn't we know about this? On every single site that's anything to do with Lyme, and it's misdiagnosed so often as lupus and MS and ALS and rheumatoid arthritis, and I can tell you,
Francis, I hate to interrupt, but a break is taking over, so we have to step away for a moment. We'll be back right after this, folks. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Frances Emma Barwood, and really a pivotal and a very, I would say, unique figure in the world of UFOs because of the fact that she stood when the onslaught was on, and she didn't give up. She kept standing, and she has my eternal respect and that of all of her constituents, I think, who had anything at all to do with reporting the Phoenix Lights. And that was, well, she had over 700 that called her, and of course, that represents a great many more than 700. Now, Francis, just a quick follow-up on what we were talking about with the Lyme disease. This is a substance, this leadum whatever, whatever you called it, is a substance that has been used for hundreds of years by native peoples, right?
It's been used for actually thousands of years by the North American and the Indians in the cold climates, and also the Northern Europeans, unbeknownst to each other. Both of them have used it. It's an evergreen bush related to philodendron. It's just an amazing thing that not only were both areas using it, but that the fact that the Russians did this research in 1991 and no one has known about it. The girl that I talked to, the naturopath, all it says, it comes from France, and all it says on this little vial is insect bites. And because they cannot make any claims, if they make claims, it has to go through the FDA, it has to go through years of study, and by which point, you know, who knows. And the whole thing is that all of our medicines and all of the antibiotics and everything is based on the original plants and herbs and all that exist in nature, except that now they're made from what they call the chemical equivalent, and it isn't the same. And I'm going to be going through some more, what do we call it, treatment by her. She's going to wait for all these blood tests that I had done last Wednesday, and they're afraid that the Lyme has attacked my liver, which it can, you know, attack one thing or the other in your body. So my next target is to clean up my liver. And, you know, I want to be 92 years old or 93 years old and be introduced at the next Phoenix Lights anniversary when it's 40 years, and I'll be introduced by the alien that they came down and they're running it now. So, you know, I want to be around for a while.
Well, that is an amazing story. It really is. I want to open up the telephone line for our audience, and if you have a question or a comment for Frances Barwood, maybe, just maybe, you're one of those people that called her way back in 1997 and reported the Phoenix Light event to her. You don't have to be in order to call us, but if you are, please call in and let us hear from you. The telephone number is 602-539-9580. If you need to call me on the toll-free line, you can do so at 1-888-223-4599. All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Don calling from Phoenix.
Hi, Don.
How you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, sir.
Good. Hi, Francis.
Hi, Don.
Hi, this is Don from the Alien Seeker News. I spoke to you last time you were on a Kevin Smith show.
Yes, you did. I remember.
Yeah. I mentioned then that it would be a good idea for you to start writing a book, and I know you've had some problems since then, but have you started any book or anything on this, with your experiences with this whole thing?
Actually, I have been putting aside my outline, and all, you know, as the things come up in my mind that I remember things, I've stored that all away, and after I'm over all of this, I will be sitting down and writing a book.
Good, good. Yeah, because I would love to read it. You know, you got a great story. And, I've lived in Phoenix for quite a few years. I was here during the Phoenix Lights, but, you know, I didn't hear about it until the next morning. My neighbor told me about it. And I also would like to have you, you can get my email from Kevin or go to my website, the Alien Secret News, but because I didn't catch all the information you were talking about, that homeopathic medication you were taking, because I have rheumatoid arthritis, and it's been going downhill for the last 6 months or so, and I've been affected big time with it. And so I'd like to find out some more information on that.
Well, and here's the interesting thing. As you go to all these Lyme disease sites, there's people who have been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis or MS or lupus and many, many other diseases. And they don't find out for 10, 15 years later that all the time it was Lyme. And,
really?
You know, it's been treated wrongly.
I've been tested for Lyme disease, I believe, but I don't know how accurate those tests are.
They're not very, and I'll give you two things to look up. Go and put on Yahoo and put on Lyme disease misdiagnosed as, and you'll come up with a very interesting, kind of looks like a newspaper article. All the misinformation out there. And then the second thing is put in the most accurate Lyme disease test, and it will show you what the most accurate is. There's like 15 different tests, and most of them will give a false negative. It's a very small window that where you get a positive.
Okay. On that medication you're taking, either get a hold of me about that or I will ask Kevin, because I did not get it, and I don't have a real clear connection now, so I'm not hearing you real clear. So I really would like to find out that homeopathic remedy that you are taking.
Okay.
It's been real important to me, because, you know, it's been a tough time for me here in the past 6 months. I've been dealing with this a number of years, but in the past 6 months, it's just disabled me quite a bit.
Well, and what's really was startling to me is that on CDC.gov, you put in Lyme disease, and it will show you it is in every single state, in Hawaii and Alaska, and in Russia and all of Europe. And right now, it's almost epidemic in California.
Oh, really?
And the tick is as big as a freckle.
I caught the gist of what you were just saying, but I'm really, it looks not all clear. So I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to play back the show back tomorrow and listen to what you said, because, like I said, I don't have a real clear connection right now, and I will ask Kevin too what that medication was that you said earlier. I'm sorry, it's just my connection is really bad right now.
Okay, Don. Well, let's hope we can help you too.
All right, Don. Thank you for the call. The telephone number, folks, is 602-539-9580 or toll-free at 1-888-223-4599. If you have a comment or a question, either about the remedy that Frances has been taking that has been such a help to her, or about her experiences with the Phoenix Lights and all of that drama that took place, give us a call, 602-539-9580 or 1-888-223-4599. Now, if you live outside of the USA or you live outside of Canada, you can use the flash message feature on my website. You just go over to my website, scroll down, and you'll see a link that says flash message. Just click on that and send me a flash message, and I'll read it, and we'll ask Frances to respond to it. Now, Frances, you've been through a lot of headache, even terrorist acts committed against you, apparently an attempt on your life, threats against your family, all because you said, what was this thing? Who's going to investigate it? And one of the things that a lot of people are talking about right now around the country, and indeed around the world, is they think that at some point, and I've even read one prediction that at some point in 2009, now I'm not saying that, but I've read a prediction to that effect, that President Obama will make official disclosure about UFOs. Now, I don't know whether he will or whether he will not. But as someone who has brought that into the public arena, and by public arena, I'm talking about government, by asking the questions that you ask. And as someone who then suffered the ridicule and suffered the threats and the attempt on your life, what do you think President Obama might face?
Well, you know, if you look back at Jimmy Carter, and he said he actually saw a UFO, and he totally believed in him, and he was going to find out all the secrets of what was going on, and then he got in office and nothing. It would be interesting. It would, you know, if it doesn't end up being a, I looked in everything and nothing's there. You know, if they really would just open up all the files and say, you know, here this may be some scary to some people or whatever, but you know, here's all the information, and you know that we found out there are other beings in this universe. I mean, otherwise, you know, my thought has always been, what a waste of space if we're all there is, and if we're the best there is, goodness. So, you know, it just seems that if they would just open up everything and say, here's all the information, and you know, some people will probably run and hide, and some people, you know, may just, you know, jump off a bridge or something. But I think the majority of people would feel curious. And but I'd have to, you know, I really don't think it will happen. I think what will happen is when they land, then, you know, you're not going to be able to cover it up anymore.
Well, they're having a devil of a time covering it up right now. And, I mean, here's the problem that they have is nobody believes them anymore. They've been caught lying so many times that, and I mean really caught, that nobody believes them anymore when they come out with their spin stories and try to explain away a UFO sighting. And, I mean, if you have a UFO sighting where you've got, you know, several thousand people see it, as in the Phoenix Lights, and then you try to just dismiss it and explain it away, you have lost 100% of your credibility. Nobody believes you. And the public has outrun the elected officers of the republic. They've just outrun them on this issue. And it's really almost to the point where the public sort of views the government on this issue as just irrelevant.
And that's true. I think it's not going to come from the government. It's going to come from the private sector. And it will probably be, you know, hopefully at some big, huge game somewhere where they'll come in and they can't cover it up, they can't shoot them down, and there they'll be, and we'll just have to deal with it at the time.
Wouldn't it be cool if they had tickets to the Super Bowl?
Really?
or to the premiership, which we call it soccer, but the rest of the world calls it football, and that's kind of their Super Bowl. And I think that happens about once every 4 years. That would be a big game to show up at. The whole world is watching that.
That's right. And, you know, no hiding. And there's something that I left out back when I was talking about Richard Curtis.
Yeah.
That I kind of wanted to go back and just clarify.
Sure.
I couldn't understand how these two men found where he lived since he didn't say it over the phone. And I had no idea where he lived at the time. And so what happened was I had always taped all of my phone calls since the death threats. And we asked the telephone company to send someone over to check out my line. And the repairman came over, and he checked out my line, and he went all the way up to the pole. And he tested everything, and he came back, and he knocked on our side window. And so I told him, come on in. He goes, no. And so I opened the window, and he said, in a very quiet voice, I am not coming in. I'm going to tell you this. You do have a tap on your line. It's in the main facility, and that means government, and you did not hear that from me, and he left. And so I realized at that point that they wanted to know who was calling me, when, what they were saying, everything. And it was really a rude awakening to me, because I had always thought that, you know, elected officials are servants of the people, and And what was happening, and as you see everywhere now, is they're the bosses, we're the peons, and it's turned around. It's not what it was meant to be.
Well, I am anything but militant. I am not militant about anything. But I am also a student of history, and I have pointed this out on the air. You can, whenever those who think they are in power start acting as if they are in power, and they become dictatorial and tyrannical, History shows when people have had enough, they string these people up. Now, I'm not saying that we should do that, and I am absolutely a loyal American. I'm just saying, what idiots. You go to Washington or to City Hall and then act like you don't work for the people, and you start bullying the people around, and you're going to shove stuff down their throat whether they want it or not. You got no reason at that point to act surprised when they show up as a lynch mob. They do it. I mean, all you got to do is look in history. Look what happened to Milosevic. He would still be in power today if his own people had not taken him down.
That's right.
And the same thing is true of Ceausescu. The same thing is true of the Soviet Union. It's when the people took it down, it came down. I have a little saying, powerful people are only as powerful as the rest of us let them be.
That's true.
And to me, it just amazes me that they act the way they do, because it is absolutely obvious from history that when people have had enough, they'll take care of business. Hey, that's how this became a country.
And we've forgotten all that, haven't we?
Yeah. Well, some people have. And, you know, but they need to remember. Have you ever considered running for the Senate?
No. it was kind of funny, because when I ran for Secretary of State, I could not believe the attacks that I got from our local news media. And it was really interesting. And the reason that I ran for Secretary of State is because the Secretary of State in Arizona is the chief elections officer. And while I was on the council, I found out there was so much fraud going on in our voter rolls, and it's still, there's still so much. But just in a random sampling, we found people voting who are convicted felons in prison voting by mail. And, it you know, the manipulation of the computers, it was rampant. And all the computers across the country is run by the same company. And if you look at who the partners are, and I won't mention his name, but he's very powerful, has lots of money, and doesn't live in, isn't an American citizen, but, you know, it gets kind of creepy. And we found that there were people in this one particular house, 16 people were voting, giving this one house as their address and another P.O. box as their mailing address. And the people who lived in that house were an elderly couple who the person who worked on the voting, you know, on voting day, recognized as they can't live there because it was next door to her. And we investigated and found out that they were all frauds. And, you know, it just boggles my mind. And that's why I ran for Secretary of State. And unfortunately, not much has been done to really clean up what is a very easy fraud. When you vote by mail, I used to be a deputy registrar, so you had to see the person, you had to get their ID, you had to swear that you saw their ID and that you saw them. Now you can put any name, and as long as you remember how you signed it for that name, you can vote as many times as you want with different names. Nobody.
But now, when you ran for Secretary of State here in Arizona, all of this stuff about the Phoenix Lights was used against you, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you a question, and I just want to get your response to this. And, folks, I want you to think about this. Let's say that in New York City, in Central Park in New York City, a 747 somehow lands in Central Park. Now, we know about a big jet aircraft that landed in the Hudson River. We know about that. Not because he wanted to, but because he had to, and what a great job he did. He was super. But let's say a 747 lands in Central Park. It doesn't crash. It lands. Now, everything about that is impossible. There's not a runway. There's not enough open space. There's no way for this plane to land, but it does. Now, Francis, would you say that that would be a big news story?
You would think so.
All right. Would you think that the city council in New York City would be asking questions like, first of all, why did you land? Secondly, how did you do that?
I would think that would be one major topic.
Yeah, especially why. You know, why did you put this plane down in Central Park? That's very dangerous to the public. So you'd want to know this question. You'd want to have it answered. And then you'd want to know, okay, now, how did you do that without crashing? I think another question would be, how are we going to get this plane out of there? All right.
That's for sure.
When you see something in the sky above Phoenix, Arizona, that's absolutely gigantic and unexplainable, it seems to me that everybody on the city council ought to be asking the question, what is that? Who's looking into this? But they went to the other side. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Frances Emma Barwood. She was on the city council in Phoenix back in 1997. That is the year that the famous Phoenix Lights incident took place. And I think it's important for us to point out that it didn't just happen. It's called the Phoenix Lights now. But it didn't just happen in Phoenix. This thing, whatever it was seen over Nevada. It flew all the way down the state of Arizona. After it left Phoenix, it flew on south toward Tucson, and there were witnesses all along its route. Did you hear from any of those people, Francis?
Oh, yes, and I think there was probably more than one craft because of how there was... from what I can gather, three different pathways. But, you know, it happened at a time of night that most people were out in Arizona. The weather was mild. And it was along the most densely populated pathway that you could pick. So what some people said was they felt it was trying to be obvious. And, you know, I don't doubt that at all. I think it was, it selected a time. I mean, if this was something that wanted to be secretive, they could have done it 3 o'clock in the morning out in the middle of the desert where, you know, a couple of drunks were, and nobody would have paid any attention whatsoever. But they didn't. They did it completely in the most densely populated pathway that you could pick at a time of night where most people were out doing all sorts of things. So it's, I just would love to know the whole story. That's where I'm at.
All right, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Stefan from Quebec City. How are you?
I'm doing great, sir. How are you?
Fantastic. Kevin, my question to Mrs. Barwood would be, if she feels that this act of showing up on their behalf, and when I say them, I say in brackets, whoever it was, if she feels that this was a preparatory act for an act in the future, if she feels that they'll show up again, and also, what reaction does she think that the media would have if it reoccurred? Does she think that they would make fun of it again?
Okay. What do you think, Francis?
Well, I do think it will happen again. I think it's been happening quite, you know, all over the entire world. I think, and maybe it's just hopeful thinking, but I really do feel that we're going to have quite a show in the near future. And I hope I'm out there watching at the time. As to the media, it's very interesting because even the other day when this balloon went up over Phoenix, and somebody called into the news station and said, oh, there's something up in the sky, they started playing the you know, doo-doo-doo music, and they were just totally making fun of it. It's like, oh, goodness, here they come again. And you know, there's very few that take these things seriously. And what's interesting, it's always the ones who have seen something that take it seriously. And I'll tell you, the reporter that wrote that article on May 10th of 1997, his name was Chris Fiscus, and I said to him, you know, you seem so interested in this. And he said, well, my mother and sister saw something that they said was not from this world. And if my mother said so, it's true. And so he wrote a very, very balanced article. The only one, the only one locally that really did a balanced article.
What happened to him? Did they come down on him about it?
Well, he was removed from the city beat and became one of the reporters in a pool of reporters for the state. And you know, he was a really, not only a good reporter, but a good person.
Mm. So you think that if when it happens again, that the media is still going to keep their head firmly implanted where they have it?
Actually, I don't think they can handle it. I think if they found out that they, you know, everything they've been making fun of was, you know, real. I mean, we are not the only ones in the universe. And I'll go back to the original text of the Old Testament. And you know the saying that everybody says is, Jesus said, in my Father's house there's many mansions.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of never made sense to me. In the original text, it's in my Father's universe there are many worlds. And they didn't want that text to be in there because it would show that we aren't the only ones. And, you know, it's inevitable. Eventually, we're going to find out.
Yeah. Stefan, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Ms. Barwood. Have a great night.
All right.
You too.
All righty, folks. The telephone line is 602-539-9580 or toll-free at 888-223-4599. If you live outside the United States and you live outside of Canada, you can use the flash message Just go over to my website and scroll down. You will see a link that says Flash Message. You can use that. The telephone numbers will work from anywhere in the world, but they're not free from anywhere else in the world. Just the toll-free number is toll-free in the USA and Canada. 602-539-9580, 888-223-4599. You know, when I talked with you earlier today, both of us were having problems with allergy, and I still have them, but we're getting through this. I just turned the mic off to cough. It's kind of funny because people who are listening by radio or on the internet, you know, internet radio, or on their iPhones, they don't hear it. But people who are watching the show on KSS TV see me cough and don't hear it. So they get if you're watching it on TV, you get a little extra there. All right. Now, Francis, Stefan brought up a real good point, and that is, when it happens again, what do you think the media is going to do? All right, let me take it a step further. All the predictions at this point are that there is going to be a very unambiguous UFO event or incident in the very near future. Now, we're hearing this from not only the normal, you know, people who are channeling and receiving mediums, receiving messages from the other side and things like that. We're also hearing it little wisps of smoke about this that are sort of leaking out of government and quasi-government organizations. So let's say that happens. Let's say that there is a very unambiguous, totally out in public, undeniable UFO event or incident in the near future. And so there's no way, I mean, we'll say an Independence Day-sized craft shows up and hovers over one of our major cities. And it's just up there for a long time, and there are lots of people taking pictures of it, lots of video of it. Even the TV news, who are generally steeped in ignorance, have to admit it's there. How do you think they'll handle this?
Well, I don't think they're going to be handling it very well. I think they're going to be the first people to totally panic, because all along they've made jokes and they've really brushed it off as, you know, that's woo-woo stuff and, you know, all these people are crazy. And I think they're going to have the hardest time accepting it. And so they'll probably be the first to panic, which would be kind of interesting. But I guess what concerns me is because of that movie Independence Day, which was, you know, kind of creepy and scary, would people think that that's how it will end up? And I truthfully don't think it will, because obviously who's ever out there, I'm sure there's good and bad out there, but who's ever been visiting and you know, looking things over and maybe trying to warn us, if they wanted to hurt us, it would have happened already, because they're so far ahead of us technology-wise and probably intelligence-wise. So I don't think it's anything to fear. I think it would be quite an exciting event. I just hope I'm looking at, out there at the time it happens, because I would really, to me, that would be like the culmination of everything. You know, you just kind of, I knew it. But I'm fairly new into this. I mean, this 12 years ago, you know, last March it was 12 years ago last May when you know, I asked that question. So, and since then, I've been sent so many things, books, tapes, pictures, everything. So it got me a very quick education, and I have no doubt that we are not alone in this universe.
Well, you know, the thing that amazes me,
Pardon me?
The thing that really amazes me about all of this, you know, I'm an ex-cop, and I watch the major cases that come along, you know, some mass murderer or, you know, the Scott Peterson case, stuff like that. I kind of follow those to see, you know, what I'm interested in is the evidence. That's what interests me. What's the evidence here? Uh-huh. And I have seen in several cases people convicted and put on death row with the flimsiest of evidence, and in fact, in some cases, no forensic evidence whatsoever. It's all circumstantial. Okay? And they get convicted, and they're put on death row. They're sentenced to die, and no evidence. And it astounds me. And then you look at UFOs. Now, you have the testimony of commercial airline pilots. You have the testimonies of military pilots. You have voice recordings of military pilots talking while they're chasing UFOs, and they're describing what they're seeing and what's happening. You have astronauts, and you have voice and video recordings of astronauts actually saying there's a UFO out there. Or in one case, the astronaut says, we still have the alien spacecraft under observance. You have other astronauts like Edgar Mitchell who says the evidence is in and it's not a question. We are not alone in the universe. The evidence is just overwhelming. If you were to go into court with it, you would win your case. And still, you have a dwindling number, but they're out there. People who say, well, you know, I don't know if I believe in that. And it just blows me away. I cannot imagine where they keep their, where are they storing their mind? We have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Frances Emma Barwood. And Frances, let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
William Warwick, and I'm calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Hi, William.
How you doing, Kevin? How you doing, Frances?
Wait a minute. Wait, let me push the button for Frances. Now she's back with us. Okay.
How you doing? I did have a couple of comments to make about the possible meaning behind the Phoenix Lights, and that the correlation that I came up with was that they clearly, whoever or whatever was responsible for the events that occurred on March 13th, it seems that they clearly wanted the symbolism of Phoenix to be featured in the sighting itself, as well as the picking of the date of the 13th. Which, if we think about the Mayan calendar, although everyone focuses on the Western calculation of the date, which is December 21st or December 22nd, 2012, if you actually write it in the form that would be native to the Mayans, it would actually be written 13.0.0.0. And if you go back to the largest witnessed UFO sighting in recorded history that we're aware of in recent history occurred at the Fatima, Portugal. They call them the apparitions of the Virgin Mary, but if you really read the original reports that have been released recently and a couple of books that have been released recently, they made it a point to make sure that they appeared on the 13th of every month beginning in May and continue on for the next 6 months, and then they told the girls that they would make a final appearance for everyone to prove that they were real on October 13th of 1917. And so I think that there is a very clear connection between these events and the fact that although the boomerangs were seen all around the world during the spring of 1997, that they chose Phoenix as the symbol of the resurrection, so to speak, which you could take.
Yeah, but William, let me ask you a question. How can you say, actually, and why do you say they chose Phoenix? Because, actually, this thing was seen traveling across Nevada and then down all the way across the state. It passed over Phoenix, but then it continued on down toward Tucson.
Well, part of the reason is because that whole area was actually, the Phoenix area in particular, was actually a place where apparently they have had contact with humans in the past. I'm speaking specifically of the Hohokam tribe, which was based out of Phoenix back in the 1200s.
Mm-hmm.
And the name Hohokam, when you translate it, actually means the vanishing ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen depictions of boomerangs with people below them, sort of symbolizing that the boomerangs took the people away, meaning the Hohokam. And I've met various Native Americans who have confided in me, for instance, the stories of, and this is actually isn't a secret story or anything, but the Hohokam allegedly had these dolls, which they called the weather dolls, which were given them to them by their, I guess they would call them the gods. And they used these weather dolls to control the weather. Not unlike something that we would consider sort of like HAARP can do today. And so it seems that that area in particular seems to be some sort of stargate, an area where they're able to come in and out of our particular dimension with ease, or more ease than they would anywhere else. And the other thing that I wanted to bring up is that it appears that they only kind of turned the lights on in the Phoenix area, as opposed to, my sighting included, they didn't have any lights on it. So it just seems to me that there has to be a least common denominator or a most common denominator amongst all of these sightings, and it seems to be that they focused on the 13th for a reason.
Okay, interesting observations. Thanks for the call, William. Francis, I have to say, I don't know if you're familiar with Jeff Woolline, but Jeff Woolline has probably taken as much and maybe even more ridicule than you were exposed to, but at least as much. And Jeff has been researching the petroglyphs out at South Mountain in particular, but also other mountains around Phoenix. And out there at South Mountain, I've been out there with him, and I've seen this with my own eyes. There is a petroglyph that shows what looks exactly like the Phoenix Lights. And just like what William just described. Have you looked into the possible connection between the Phoenix Lights and South Mountain and the ancient people who lived here?
No, but I'll tell you, I'm part Iroquois.
Mm-hmm.
I was born on the 13th of January, so I don't know. But I have no doubt that some of the stories from the elders that have been handed down through generations talks of beings that came from the sky and went back.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's very fascinating.
Well, this is the first time, Williams calls, the first time I've heard about them being able to control the weather. But, you know, you would think, look, you live in this area. Imagine what this is in the summertime in the year 1200.
Oh.
No air conditioning, no city water, no swimming pools. You know, and you know what this desert is like in the summertime out here.
But then there's no asphalt, no heat sink. And I went through one summer here, actually my first summer, where my air conditioning went out, and it was 1980, and I couldn't afford to get the air conditioning fixed. So we had read a book about the pioneers, and they slept with wet sheets and just fans, you know, whatever they could muster up, and they made it through, and so did I. Lost 20 pounds, which was probably a good thing, but, you know, you think way back, and the Native Americans were pretty smart, mm-hmm. and they knew how to keep themselves cool, and, you know, just by their different structures, and some of the things that existed before they were again discovered, if you think back, there had to be some intelligent instruction in our distant past, and I don't think it came from us. I think it came from elsewhere, because mm-hmm. there are things that were made and constructed and built and, you know, all of these things that were well beyond what the knowledge of the humans in this world were at the time.
Well, when you look at this desert and then think about the first white settlers that cast their eyes upon this desert where Phoenix is sitting, and then you just think about what was it that made that first settler say, "This is it, Ma."
Yep.
You know, there's no water. There's water to the north, south, east, and west, but mm-hmm. there's no water. There is now because we've brought it here. There's no water. It's so hot, you're in the suburbs of hell. I have figured out what it was that caused the first settler to say, "This is it, Ma." You know what it was?
What?
A broken wagon wheel. He just couldn't go anymore, and the way he said it was not, "This is it, Ma." He said, "Oh, this is it, Ma."
Oh, that's good. Well, you know, and think about, like, the canals that existed here.
Yeah.
And how efficient they were. And, you know, so you think, well, who told them how to do this in this particular way, and it was a monumental undertaking. So, you know, I think of that often. I watch a lot of documentaries on the History Channel and National Geographic Channel, and you look at the distant past.
Oh, yeah, it was phenomenal. Francis, we're out of time, and the music has started. I want to thank you for being with us again. It's always fascinating when you're here. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment. I'd like to talk with you after the show for just a moment. And again, thanks for being here. Well, that's it, folks. That's a wrap. And it's time for me to say that my friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.
Bye.